Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and to look at the last decade of egregious cases of corporate fraud, one might conclude that there's a club somewhere full of people who saw it coming. Just as executives say, there's no way anyone could have known the numbers were askew. In 2001, Enron's Sharon Watkins had serious concern about the company's finances and later testified about the fraud. In 2003, three Fannie Mae employees questioned that firm's accounting. More recently, Matthew Lee, a senior vice president at Lehman Brothers, sent a letter to senior management and to his lawyer May 2008, months before the company filed for bankruptcy in September of that year, noting six different concerns he had about the company's accounting practices. But for those whistleblowers and others at financial firms, pharmaceutical companies, government agencies, energy companies, manufacturers, and within the military, the decision to come forward is never an easy one, and the legal protections, once they do, are often found lacking. Joining me to talk about how to bring corporate misdeeds to light are two guests, Tom Devine, legal director of the Government Accountability Project and co-author of a brand new book called The Corporate Whistleblower Survival Guide, a handbook for committing the truth, and Dr. Jeffrey Wigand, tobacco industry whistleblower and subject of the movie The Insider, who wrote the foreword to The Corporate Whistleblower Survival Guide. Welcome, both of you, to WNYC. Thank you so much for coming on.
Howdy.
Morning.
And Dr. Wigand, you're one of the most famous whistleblowers ever. People remember you from The Insider, from 60 Minutes. You write in the foreword to this book about how difficult it was to blow the whistle when you were an employee of the Brown & Williamson Tobacco Corporation. You started there in order to develop a safer cigarette. For those of our listeners who aren't familiar with your story, very briefly, what happened after you blew the whistle?
Well, I mean, I was sued by the industry. I was threatened with incarceration if I was to violate my agreement. I was followed. There were death threats to my two children that required armed bodyguards. It was a torturous process from 1993 through June 20th of 1997.
And yet, given all that, and most of those threats and everything else were after you actually lost your job,
yep. Even given
all that, you write in the foreword that when people ask you if you would do it again, you respond yes and in a New York minute. But is there anything you would do differently? Are there some key things in the survival guide, before we even talk to the author, that you wish you knew about at the time?
Well, I mean, as a scientist, I mean, you always go back and look up what has happened in the past and see what you can glean and learn from past experiences. It's a balancing act. And the balancing act I had to do is between the truth, which would save numerous lives in throughout the world that are caused by the loss of life, I mean, through the use of tobacco, and my children, because the death threats that I received were directed towards my children, and the balancing act was one of deciding which would do it and which way would I do it if I chose to do it. I would say in the end, I made the choice to go forward with their understanding as much as you can have with a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old. Mm. But would I do it all over again differently? Probably not, because I think there was a tremendous chemistry and alignment of stars that permeated the whole process. I mean, the Attorney General's support, the Department of Justice support, the FBI support, the school teachers' support, the students' support, and my belief that the truth, I was obligated to the truth. Now, and the truth was that the industry had intentionally, for profit, put millions of lives at risk and took millions of lives each year with a product they newly knew, when used as intended, killed. But also at the same time, after watching the CEOs get up in front of Congress and swearing an oath to tell the truth, by me not doing anything, I was guilty of what I would call bystanderism. Bystanderism is you do nothing, and therefore you're just as culpable as those that are doing the harm.
The crime of remaining the crime of remaining silent. And listeners, I wonder if anybody's out there who, obviously Dr. Wigand's case was very celebrated, and he individually became very celebrated and did, as he was just saying, get the FBI and others on his side. I wonder if anybody's listening who, much more out of the media limelight and without a lot of cheerleaders on your side, brought to light unethical or illegal activity by your employer, whether it be private sector or public sector, or people listening who considered it but ultimately decided not to, maybe because the risks to you were just too great. Any whistleblowers or people who thought about it and then declined to become whistleblowers? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. As we talk about this new book, The Corporate Whistleblower Survival Guide, A Handbook for Committing the Truth. And co-author Tom Devine, legal director of the Government Accountability Project. Tom, some of your essential survival tips, maybe the top three might be: seek legal advice early, don't embellish your charges, and keep a record as you go and secure all relevant records immediately. Then you go on to consider working within the system, test the waters for support among your workplace peers, and check for skeletons in your own closet. I guess that's because they'll come after you and try to discredit you, and consult your loved ones. So I guess that all, it's all common sense, but maybe not everybody thinks it through all that much.
Well, this is not a rational decision, Brian. It's and it needs to be, because it's one of the most serious choices that a person can make, for better or worse. Your life will never be the same after making this decision, whichever way you go. If you stay passive, it may haunt you the rest of your life, as Jeff was alluding to. But if you just charge ahead and act emotionally in challenging abuses of power by perhaps a multinational corporation, you'll be crushed like an insect, and you won't have accomplished anything except to ruin your own life. So it's a very, very serious decision. It's also one that depends on a magic word, solidarity. Solidarity from the people who are affected by your decision, which means you have to make that choice with them rather than just telling them that you've made a nobly heroic decision that is going to have an extreme impact on their life, but they weren't enfranchised
yes.
to be part of it.
And in fact, that was the one out of the six bullet points that I was going to ask you about. First, test the waters for support among your workplace peers, which, among other things, puts you in a difficult decision even before you firmly decide to blow the whistle, because then you start leaking to other people in your workplace that you've got a suspicion about something.
Well, it's a good reason why you should have a coach or an expert navigator to help you. You don't just go start issuing those charges within the workplace. Start asking questions, checking if other people are scratching their heads about the same problem. Have they been concerned about this issue? Bring it up at meetings. Are we going to be risking liability through this choice? Testing the waters. That's one reason that you need to do that is you may be mistaken. A lot of people have the snapshot syndrome, something that looks bad in isolation mm-hmm. is just fine in context. But another reason is you cannot do this alone. Mm-hmm. And if there isn't support from other workers, other mm-hmm. witnesses, then you may want to choose an anonymous hotline
yes.
as a way to do the right thing
uh-huh.
rather than sticking your neck out.
Dr. Wigand, did you have that peer support?
No, I did not have the peer support overtly. I would say within the context of the company, the people did support the statements I made and the knowledge I had, but had a deep reticence and reluctance to come forward, which left me in a quandary, because I believed by me coming forward, others would follow, and that didn't happen. But clearly, when I thought this through, in order to maximize the public protection I needed, I went to 60 Minutes. And 60 Minutes was facilitated the coming out, so to speak. The Wall Street Journal then joined in. The New York Times joined in. The L.A. Times, the Washington Post. I mean, it was the timing was perfect.
You
I would say
media.
The alignment of stars was good.
You got the media on your side, which, again, not everybody is going to have that.
Not everybody's going to have it. And I mean, the other thing is that you got to make sure you have your facts and the truth. And I mean, I knew the truth. I knew that once the documents and the company would be released and put in the public domain, they would see the truth. Unfortunately, what I did not do and was remove documents from the company, because that would have been an illegal, immoral act on my part. I left the company escorted out by two police officers. While I was being terminated, they had already rummaged through my desk and removed all the documents I had on my own personal desk, including my own daily diary that I had, which I kept. It was a chronology of events that I felt that broached or breached the what I would say both ethical and legal issues. But it did come out in the end, and I mean, a lot of it came out vis-a-vis the media, but also the discovery process of the lawsuits instituted by the various attorneys general of the states. They were actually able to pull the documents out.
Right, and again, it became a very public case, and so you had all these state attorneys general as well as all these media outlets, and not everybody's going to have that, I guess, privilege or luxury, if those are the right words. Let's hear one caller's story of blowing the whistle recently, I think. Munir in Totowa, you're on WNYC. Hello, Munir. Thank you for calling in.
Yeah, hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I mean, this is such a sad story because I only question an outsourcing company. He and his buddies were involved not in millions but billions in fraud. And they skimmed the not just the New Jersey Treasury, but the Uncle Sam, and they're cheating the bank. So I questioned it, and he went to the municipal court in his backyard and filed a bogus harassment complaint against me. And the judge found me guilty of and gave me a 30-day suspended sentence.
Guilty of what?
A jail sentence. And now I can't even find a job. My CPA is gone.
Munir, thank you. And, of course, we can't verify anything that Munir says or anything that anybody says against Munir. Tom Devine, is this something that might actually happen? The company would get the criminal justice system to file some kind of bogus charge against you?
Oh, it's one of the classic retaliation tactics is to try and prosecute the whistleblower. And the key thing when you're testing the waters is not to expose yourself as a threat to the institution, but as a loyal employee who's worried about threats to the institution making sure that we don't make a mistake, but not posing yourself as a potential adversary.
We've got about a minute and a half left. I want to touch two things, Tom, with you very, very briefly. One is we should acknowledge that you and your group worked with our program on the media to kind of figure out which senator was putting an anonymous hold on the Whistleblowers Protection Act in the Senate, which one lone senator was able to anonymously kill. Did that bill ever pass? And do people have the protection of the government to the extent that you would want them to? Very briefly.
The bill has been reintroduced. It hasn't passed yet, but thanks to WNEW, the senator's office who put the hold on it has promised to never do that again. You folks have made a difference.
To WNYC. Thank you.
WNYC. And the second question is, the answer is we've emerged for corporate workers. Federal employees still don't have a fighting chance to defend themselves until that law passes. But for corporate workers, we've emerged from the dark ages and had a legal revolution in corporate freedom of speech starting in 2000, in this millennium, and it's like we've reached the promised land for what legal rights can do for you
if you can afford a due process hearing, if you can afford a day in court. But only about 20% of whistleblowers who are fired have the money to do that. After all, they're unemployed. And for the other 80% who have to rely on informal investigations, things that don't actually give you a chance to go to court,
we have to leave
they
it
don't
here
have a chance.
Because we're out of time. But there are the basics, folks. And if you are potentially in this position, I'm sure you'll want to consult this new book, The Corporate Whistleblower's Survival Guide by Tom Devine and Tarek Masrani, with a foreword by Dr. Jeffrey Wigand. Thank you both for a very, very important segment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.